Hello, everyone. And Jacqueline, I enjoyed listening to that book by Tess Hughes. I also, in the last few days, watched the video of your interview with her, and I really enjoyed that as well. So maybe I'll get the book. So hi, everyone, and welcome to the 7 Steps to Awakening. Tonight, we're going to begin by looking at, quote, 733. And let me just post that here in the room for you. Now, of course, this isn't quote 733. This is my journal entry. After I contemplate the quote, I do some writing. I like to write. It's just natural for me to write as I contemplate. And what I write about the 7 steps gets put in my 7 steps journal, which is online. And so when you click on this link, you are not going to the 7 steps to awakening. You are going to Regina's journal about the 7 steps to awakening. Also, I just want to say that the fall retreat is coming up in a month. And I think Jacqueline announced this morning there's really only 2 more weeks to register because we have to give final numbers on meals and rooms to the retreat center 2 weeks prior to the event. So about 2 weeks left to register. And what I'm planning to do at the Regina Dawn Akers retreat is help people become skilled and confident with skills that help us to awaken, contemplation being one of them. I think contemplation is a very important skill. It's a way to tap into that inner wisdom that we all have. You know, we all have the same inner wisdom. We have the mistake that we learn from books. But, you know, you got to ask, where do those books come from? You know, the wisdom that's in these books, the wisdom of Nisargadatta Maharaj, the wisdom of Ramana Maharshi, the wisdom of Buddha, the wisdom of Shankara, you know, where did this wisdom come from? And that's the inner wisdom, and it's the exact same inner wisdom that we each have. Whenever we all go deep enough within and learn from within, we learn the exact same thing. There's no differences. But not everybody knows how to tap into that deep, deep inner well. And contemplation is one way to tap into that deep, deep inner well and just get clarity day after day after day. Jesus called it the daily bread. And so one of the things that I plan to do at the retreat is help people learn to contemplate so that you can tap into your own inner well. I also plan to help people learn how to ask really good questions, really good inquiry, so that they can see through their own ego. Because that's another important skill, and you know, it can be very, very challenging to see through our ego because we think we're right. Because we think we're right about what we believe and what we perceive. So learning how to ask the right questions in order to really look at the ego, look at our thoughts, our thinking, and see through it, and become free of that filter is another very important awakening skill. So I'm also going to help with that as well. I'm going to help people, learn to practice meditation, awareness watching, awareness meditation. You know, many of us here learned about awareness watching, awareness meditation from Michael Langford. But if you've read his book, The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, he says that he discovered it when contemplating the quotes of masters like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I learned awareness watching, awareness directly from Michael. His books are so clear, we don't have to decode anything. They're clear and they're simple. But since I've learned it, it seems like every master that I turn to, I see now that they're recommending the same thing. That there's this one recommendation as what I call the final practice, but what Michael calls the direct path. And so that's another skill that we will practice at the retreat. And there are some others as well. But I just wanted to mention it because lately I've had this idea in my mind. It's kind of like a title, and the title is Awakening at Home. What we need are the skills so that we can practice awakening at home. And so what I want to do at the retreat is help people to again become confident in these skills so that after the retreat, they can go home and practice awakening at home. That's really the purpose of the retreat. So if you haven't registered yet, and if it sounds like this might be helpful to you, I perceive it as something that will be very helpful to a lot of people. Please remember there's only 2 weeks left to register. And, of course, you can find the link for the Awakening Together Fall Retreat at awakening-together.com under the event menu and at reginadonacres.com under the retreats menu. And with that said, what I think I would like to do is play a tune. I don't know which one yet, so let's see what comes. Well, here's one. Well, that's just piano music, though. Should I play that? No, I think I won't. I think I'll feel like some words. So let's see what else we got here. Oh, this one's kind of fun. This is just a fun one. But this next song, Jason Gray is singing to God. The name of the song is Good to Be Alive, and it's really a song of gratitude. But I find that, again, as I let go of more and more false thinking and become freer and freer of false thinking, that this natural joy of life is extremely spontaneous and doesn't require any special circumstances. You know, the joy just bursts forth even if I'm, cleaning the shower. it doesn't matter what it is, just things, just being alive, I think, itself, just life itself feels so good. So this is what this song is really about, I think. This is what Jason is singing about. So here's Jason Gray singing Good to Be Alive.
Right now, while the sun is
feet, and it must be time to begin because Jamie just curled up in her bed, and that's what she does when I'm teaching. She lays here and sleeps. In fact, when I was in Ireland at one of the retreats, we were listening to some of my meditation audios and practicing meditation, and in one of them, you can hear Jamie snoring all through the meditation. So she's crawled into bed, so I think it is time for us to begin. So, as I mentioned, we're going to start tonight with quote 733 from The Seven Steps to Awakening. So this is a link to 733 in my journal. Let me read quote 733. Oops, I'm open to 773. I opened up to the wrong combination of those same numbers. All right, here we are, 733. When the movement of the mind has ceased, the self shines by its own light. In that light, all sorrow comes to an end, and there is the bliss which the self experiences in itself. I'll read that again. When the movement of the mind has ceased, the self shines by its own light. In that light, all sorrow comes to an end, and there is the bliss which the self experiences in itself. I think that particular quote goes really well with the song we were just listening to and the story that I told, the brief story that I told just before playing the song. I mentioned that as I let go of more and more false thinking, that there's just this happiness, this joy. And sometimes it gets pretty big. Sometimes I feel like I just want to shout to the world how happy I am. I don't always, because some of the people that are around me when I'm feeling that aren't as happy, and I, you know, it doesn't seem compassionate to shout how happy I am. But I feel it. And as I mentioned to you, you know, I feel it, you know, cleaning the shower, or doing anything. And I remember when I started the spiritual path, and even then I perceived myself as happy. You guys may have heard me say before that the very first thing Jesus had to show me was that I wasn't happy, because I thought that I was. And the way that happened was one of the great joys in my life, or what I thought was one of the great joys in my life, was my daughter. I had adopted Jasmine from China as a single mom. I had always wanted to be a mom, and now I had this wonderful gift of this wonderful child. And Jasmine really was a wonderful child. We had a great relationship. We did lots of fun things together. You know, she was very young then, but you know, like 1 year we made all of the Christmas ornaments for the tree, and the whole tree was decorated with handmade Christmas ornaments. And we spent a year studying different countries, like a month on Australia and a month on Brazil. And when we were studying the countries, we'd read stories, we'd listen to music, we'd cook meals from those countries. You know, we just did a lot of stuff together, and we just really had a great relationship. When I was reading A Course in Miracles, there's a place not too far from the beginning where Jesus makes some kind of a statement like, you know, you think you're happy or something like that. And I did. I did think I was happy. But then Jesus comments, you know, that that's not true. I don't remember exactly how he says it, but the idea was that was not true. I was not happy. And you know, some people talk about how they have these experiences where they throw the course across the room. I never did that with A Course in Miracles, but I yelled at the book that day. I yelled at the book when Jesus was telling me, and however he's saying it in the course, that I only think I'm happy, but I'm not happy. I yelled at the book. I yelled, "Prove it." Which now, with the level of awakening that's occurred now, if I found myself yell, "Prove it," I'd know that there was something there. But then, I wasn't that sophisticated. And I was just yelling, "Prove it," to Jesus. I didn't turn around and look at myself. But an amazing thing happened. It's almost as if my perfect little daughter, Jasmine, turned into a demon. I don't know what happened. I really, except that I yelled, "Prove it," to Jesus. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. I yelled, "Prove it," to Jesus. And Jasmine suddenly became very uncooperative. She would do things like hang on me. You know, I'm trying to move around the house, you know, cook dinner, do dishes, whatever. She's hanging on me saying, "Mama, mama, mama," you know, wanting my attention. And there were a couple times she kicked me even. And I just found all this rage and hatred coming up. And what I really came to see was, even though I thought I was happy, you could say I had surface happiness, and not everybody in the world even has surface happiness. So in that way, compared to other people in the world, I was happy. Some people have surface misery. I had surface happiness. But what was lurking right underneath that surface happiness was hatred, anger, self-loathing, and all of these other things. And so it started coming up, and it started coming up in my relationship with Jasmine. And it got pretty bad. At least, you know, it felt pretty bad. And the short version of the story is, because it's a very long story, but the short version of the story is I discovered root cause inquiry. And I discovered how to start questioning my own thoughts and looking at what I was believing. And I discovered rest, accept, and trust, and how to let go of that. And I began what I call the purification process, which the primary relationships in the purification process were Jasmine and then Laurent. And this process lasted, the process continues, the purification continues now, but there was just this huge chunk that was very intense, and that lasted about 5 years. And when that 5 years of purification ended, I found true happiness. And true happiness has a much cleaner feel to it. And it has no cause. It has no cause. And that's why, you know, the happiness, just the joy is there, you know, cleaning the shower, you know. Now, do I notice this happiness 100% of the time? No. Because I still have the power to misperceive and misbelieve for a temporary period of time. And when I make that mistake, then the happiness gets covered up, kind of like a cloud covering up the sun for a moment. But then now I am sophisticated enough that when the happiness is covered up, when I don't feel that happiness, I can look, I can see what I just now believed. I can choose very quickly to let it go, and the happiness returns very quickly. So, the quote again. When the movement of the mind has ceased, the movement of the mind, the movement of the mind would be what I was calling the misperceiving and the believing. The believing of my thinking, the believing of my thoughts. That is the movement of the mind. When the movement of the mind has ceased, or when the believing of my own thoughts has ended, And actually, in the teachings of Inner Ramana, he refers to that as interest in our own thoughts. He says we must lose interest in our own thoughts. And I think that that most definitely happens. I think in the beginning, we are all very, very interested in what I think, you know, you know, whoever your I is, you know, I'm very, very interested in what I think. In fact, there's nothing I'm more interested in than what I think. You know, we may think that we value our children. We may think that we value our partner. We may think that we value our money. We may think that we value our home, whatever we think that we value. But the truth is what we value the most is our thoughts. So there's a lot of interest in what I think. But as we go along this path and we look at those thoughts more carefully and we really see in a very direct way that the only time I am not happy is when I'm believing a thought, there's a direct relationship there. It's not that there's a cause for happiness. Happiness is natural, but there's a cause for not being happy. Not being happy has a cause, and that's believing my own thoughts. And when we see that, and we also know how much we love being happy, because we really do love being happy, that's also very natural, to love happiness, then we do begin to lose interest in our own thoughts, right? And of course, in Miracles, it says that the Holy Spirit teaches through contrast. So that contrast of experiencing that causeless happiness along with caused suffering, and realizing that the only cause of suffering is believing my thoughts, that teaches me that I don't want my thoughts, that I don't value my thoughts. In the beginning, again, we value our thoughts above everything else. You know, people wouldn't say that if you took a microphone and went on the streets of Boston or New York City or Chicago or Pueblo or anywhere and, you know, interviewed people and said, so what is it that you value most? You're probably not going to find anyone that says, my thinking. You know, they're all, maybe some really intellectual person will say my brain, you know, my high IQ. But most people are not going to say my thinking. But the truth is that is what they value the most. And this is what you discover on this path, that what you value the most is your thinking. But when you learn that that thinking is exactly what's causing your suffering, whether it's a high degree or a low degree of suffering, it doesn't matter, it's your thinking that's causing it, and you see this time and time and time and time again, you are wise enough to realize that your thinking is not serving you, and therefore that value that you gave it begins to die. And as that value that you gave it begins to die, you do begin to simply lose interest in your own thinking. So again, quote 733 says, when the movement of the mind has ceased, the self shines by its own light. And that's just true. Happiness is our nature. And I remember a point in that 5-year purification period finding that very hard to believe, you know, because once I said to Jesus, prove it, and things began to happen in my life to push all of my buttons, I went from surface happiness to a long, long ways from happiness, not even hardly able to remember what it felt like to be happy. And when I went into that darkness, it was pretty hard to believe that happiness was my natural state, because happiness was nowhere. I couldn't even remember what it was like. But happiness is our natural state. And any time we are not perfectly happy, it is because in that moment we are believing the thinking in the mind. And so if we lose interest in the mind, if we come to see that we don't value our thinking, that we value our heart. We value the present moment. We value our intuition. These are three wonderful things to value. And we start really valuing them by giving them our attention, our interest. What we find is that happiness is natural. That we are just happy with what is. And of course, I know that you all know the Bible calls this the peace that passeth understanding. And it doesn't really passeth understanding, not for the one who has discovered causeless happiness. It makes all the sense in the world from this point of view. But for the ones who have not yet discovered causeless happiness, and that, of course, is the vast majority of the people in the world, they still believe happiness has a cause. They still believe that only under certain circumstances can one be happy. And there are definitely circumstances where you just can't be happy because that's just not good, and how could anybody be happy with that? And when someone who has learned causeless happiness has learned basically to lose interest in the thoughts, to just be in the moment, to just be in natural acceptance, natural curiosity, all of that, then things happen that can appear bad, and yet the one who knows causeless happiness is still happy. And the one who does not know causeless happiness looks at that and does not understand. Does not understand how you could be happy with that situation. And so they call it the peace that passeth understanding. But it's only hard to understand for the person who still thinks happiness has a cause. For the one who has lost interest in the movement of the mind and has learned that happiness is our natural state, being happy under all circumstances makes perfect sense. It's just natural. It's as natural as breathing. Happiness is as natural as breathing. Probably even more natural, actually. But from this perspective, it's as natural as breathing, as natural as the heart beating, as natural as the eyes blinking, right? Oh, and, you know, Teddy is typing something very true. I've learned this myself. It's a part of the maturity of happiness. Teddy says, for the ones who have not yet discovered causeless happiness, because they will be upset when you are happy for no reason and swear you are laughing at them and being less than honest with them. I haven't yet had anyone accuse me of being less than honest, but I have had, like, Jasmine and Danielle sometimes get upset when I laugh. You know, why are you laughing? Are you laughing at me? Like, no. I'm really not. I'm laughing because I'm happy. And what I have learned is that sometimes I need to keep that happiness kind of within the skin. You know, like sometimes if I let the happiness out, I mentioned that a while ago, if I let the happiness out and the people around me aren't happy, it upsets them. And so I've learned to be quietly happy in some circumstances, that it's not something that constantly has to be blurted out, constantly has to be shown off. It isn't always welcomed. So I've learned to be quietly happy. I think that's just a part of the maturing process. Yeah. So back to the quote. When the movement of the mind has ceased, the self shines by its own light. In that light, all sorrow comes to an end, and there is the bliss which the self experiences in itself. The bliss which the self experiences in itself. Phil is saying people in the world think being happy without a reason is a mark of insanity. Yeah. The truth is, it's natural and it's also easy. Sometimes people still expect me to get upset at them. Just recently, a friend of mine who's here in the room now, a couple days ago, was saying to me something like, "You were upset because I did this," or "You were upset because I did that," and none of that was true. You know, it was all imagination. Hey. But I thought about that after the conversation. I thought, you know, once upon a time I would have been upset. She's not wrong about that. Once upon a time I would have been upset. I'm not at all. But the reason I'm not upset, and this is very, very interesting, is because it takes too much energy. It's too hard to get upset. And I think Jesus talks to us about this in the Course too. You know, he talks about, I don't remember exactly the words, but he talks about the effort, you know, the effort it takes to be in the wrong mind. And that's a true statement, but we're so used to expending that effort that we don't notice it. And as we go through, again, the purification process and we become more accustomed to, you can become accustomed to the natural happiness. You know, you can get used to that environment. And as you get used to the environment of the natural happiness and a situation comes around that, you know, you could get upset if you wanted to. You still have free will. But you just don't want to work that hard. You do come to see that it's hard work to get upset and to get angry and to hold that position, and you just don't want to. It's kind of like getting used to sitting on the beach in Hawaii, and you don't want to grab a suit and a briefcase and go back to the streets of New York City. You know, you kind of like sitting on the beach in Hawaii, and you just don't have the energy to go back to New York City, right? It's really like that. And so that's why, you know, things will happen and I can see that it happened and I can even see that it might have been my preference that it happened differently. Like, oh, you know, I probably would have preferred that it didn't happen that way, but you know what? It did happen that way and that's not worth leaving the beach for, right? That's what it feels like. It's not worth leaving the beach for. I like the beach. All right, so again, quote 733, when the movement of the mind has ceased, the self shines by its own light. In that light, all sorrow comes to an end, and there is the bliss which the self experiences in itself. And we've done all of this talking, and we haven't even looked at the journal entry yet. So here's a link to the journal again for anyone who doesn't have it. And I'm going to go look at the journal entry. This was written on June 6th of 2013. This is what I wrote after contemplating quote 733. Mind's judgment chooses good and bad, favorable and not favorable, etc. In good and bad, favorable and not favorable, there is happiness and not happy. Without definition, there is being, which is presence, happiness, constant. And if you're not looking at the journal, I hyphenated that like I was making up a new word. Let me type it for you in the room. If I can remember how to spell presence. Happiness, constant. That's the word. Presence, happiness, constant. Without being, without definition, without the definition of good and bad, without the definition of favorable and not favorable, there is just being. And just being is presence, happiness, constant. What are my definitions of happy? What is good or bad, favorable or unfavorable? Now that's an example of inquiry. In fact, let me just talk a little bit about contemplation and inquiry. Contemplation was reading this quote, usually slowly and at least a few times. And not thinking about the quote, but just being with the quote. You know, kind of like you might be with a cup of coffee or be with a cup of tea. You know how, especially on certain mornings, maybe it's a little cool outside and you have that cup of coffee or that cup of tea, and it's not just the drinking of it, but the holding of the cup in the hands and the warmness. And you know how you just sit and you just be with that? Right? You're just being with your cup of coffee or your cup of tea, and that's how I be with a quote. Right? It's not thinking about it. It's not analyzing it. You don't analyze your cup of coffee or cup of tea. You just be with it, right? That's how I be with a quote. But when I be with a quote, what happens is I begin to see with the quote. I begin to get insight. And that's when I grab my pen and I begin to write. So what happened with quote number 733, when I was being with the quote, I began to see with the quote. And here's what I saw. That mind's judgment chooses good and bad, favorable and not favorable, etc. And that if I'm believing the mind's judgment when it's making those choices of good and bad, favorable and not favorable, I am going to experience happiness and not happiness, right? When I'm believing the good and the favorable, I'll experience happiness. But when I'm believing the bad and the not favorable, I'll experience not happiness. And I also saw that without that definition of good and bad, favorable and not favorable, then there's just being, like being with a cup of coffee, being with a cup of tea. There's just being without any favorableness or good and bad. And I saw that that just being is what I called presence, happiness, constant. In fact, I saw that being and presence, happiness, constant are synonymous. Now that's the insight that came from contemplating the quote. After the insight came, I went into inquiry. Because I'm not really interested in wisdom for wisdom's sake, believe it or not. I'm interested in wisdom because it helps me to awaken. And so in order for this wisdom to help me to awaken, I now need to take it and I need to look back at myself and I need to find where I continually make mistakes or where I continue to make mistakes. And so I took the wisdom and I turned it into inquiry and I began looking at myself. What are my definitions of happy? Where do I still have conditions that I'm believing? Where do I still believe happiness is caused by certain circumstances or situations? I also asked what is good or bad, favorable or unfavorable. So this is looking at myself. And although this doesn't show up in the Seven Steps Journal, This is a part of the contemplation that I would now keep in my mind for the next several days after contemplating a quote like this. I would literally watch myself. I would watch for any time that I was not perfectly happy. And then I would look at my mind to see why. Look in that moment to see what I'm believing. And so in that way, the quote becomes a practice. And in fact, for those of you who are really familiar with the Seven Steps to Awakening, you know in the beginning of the book, this is what Michael Langford asks us to do with the quotes, is to contemplate each quote until there's some insight, and then also to ask, what would I have to do to put this purpose or this insight into practice? So that's why the inquiry happened next. This was giving me a practice. And then the next thing, I haven't finished reading what was in the journal yet. The next thing is, do not be fooled by defined happiness. It is not presence, happiness, constant. That's another insight. Not only an insight, I would call that a remembrance, a reminder. a self-coaching, right? A self-coaching. That is telling me not to be fooled by defined happiness. You know, I'm happy because my boyfriend is being the way I want him to be right now. Don't be fooled by defined happiness, because defined happiness has an opposite, and that's when he's not being the way I want him to be. Now I can't be happy, right? Defined happiness, the good, the favorable, is not the same as the presence happiness constant that has no cause. So I was telling myself to be alert, don't be fooled, by a defined happiness, because it has an opposite. Okay, now, Teddy did ask a question a little bit ago that I made note of but didn't answer, because sometimes when I'm on a roll, I like to stay on a roll. But he asked me if I can access inner wisdom without a quote, and the answer is yes. I personally have two ways of consciously accessing inner wisdom, and then there are times that inner wisdom accesses me, right? But I have two ways of consciously accessing inner wisdom. One is contemplation, and the other is asking a question. I can ask a question of inner wisdom and get an answer. So those are my two ways of accessing inner wisdom. And then also inner wisdom can just access us, right? If we are just open to it, right, it can access us. Yeah, so it goes two ways. Exactly. Teddy says yes. But I do love contemplation. Contemplation is definitely one of my primary tools. Yeah, so let me read this journal entry again, and we'll just look at the whole thing. Mind's judgment chooses good and bad, favorable and not favorable, etc. In good and bad, favorable and not favorable, there is happiness and not happy. Without definition, there is being, which is presence, happiness, constant. What are my definitions of happy? What is good or bad, favorable or unfavorable? Do not be fooled by defined happiness. It is not presence, happiness constant. And so with that, I am going to move on to quote 734. And let me share the link to my journal for 734. There you go. All right, 734 says, I am that which is beyond the body, mind, and senses. That is quote 734, and I do believe that all of these quotes right now that I'm looking at come from the Yoga Vasistha. Yes, these are step 3 of the 7 steps to awakening, and these particular quotes come from the Yoga Vasistha. Quote 734 is, I am that which is beyond the body, mind, and senses. And I think once upon a time I might have run across sentences like this. I don't know that for sure, but even if I didn't run across sentences like this, I had an imagination, you know, based on spiritual teachings that I was contemplating, such as A Course in Miracles and NTI. I had an imagination, and I might have been able to say, oh yeah, I know I'm that which is beyond the body, mind, and senses, but I had an imagination of what that was. Oh yeah, I know I'm that. And the that I imagined was something different and separate from what I am. It was something that did not seem accessible. It was something I had to work to reach, something I had to clean myself up to be worthy of. And if I said, oh yeah, I know I'm that, that would have just been because of intellectual reading, right? The intellectual reading told me I'm that. So I say, oh yeah, I know I'm that. But then in the next breath, I could turn around and say, but how do I get there? You know, how do I, you know I'm that, but, right? But. And what's happened for me now is noticing I'm that here and now. Noticing that which is present, which is what I am. And in fact, it's so obvious that it's what I am, it's impossible to deny it. Watching that which is here and now, that is what I am, that is absolutely changeless, constantly present, silently aware, not at all involved in the mind. Observant of the body, animating the body, growing the hair, I watch for that. I love the practice of watching that. And seeing that it is what I am, and that is absolutely undeniable. You know, I can let go of a thought. If I have a thought, you know, what kind of a thought? That there shouldn't be so much sugar in my tea. And because there's too much sugar in my tea, actually, I've never ever complained about too much sugar in my tea, okay? I don't know why I have this example. I like sweet tea. But anyway, if I'm complaining because there's too much sugar in my tea and I'm unhappy, and then I realize, oh, I'm unhappy just because I think the tea shouldn't have so much sugar in it, I can choose to let go of that thought, and I can be happy again, right? So I can believe a thought, or I can choose to let go of a thought. That means I'm not the thought. Because if I can let go of it, it's not what I am. It's a manifestation, but it's not what I am. When I look for what I really am, I find that subtle isness, presence, awareness, life, here, nowness, right? And there's no way I can separate myself from it. It's impossible. And I love watching that. I love noticing that. I love growing in awareness of that as what I am. And seeing that it's a fact. That I've only been fooled. I've only been deluded into thinking I was something else. And it's the most obvious thing in the world when we pause to look. And yet what's also interesting is that delusion is a habit. And in fact, delusion is a very strong habit. And because delusion is such a strong habit, I need to spend a lot of time noticing myself. So it's really nice that I happen to love noticing myself. It's not a chore. And in fact, one thing that seems to happen as I spend time noticing myself is that I love it even more. Like that love of the truth grows. It is like falling in love. This is what Michael Langford says in his book, How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love. And he's teaching the loving consciousness method of meditation, which to me is very much like awareness, watching awareness, but with devotion, with love. And he says in that book, it's like falling in love. And he talks about how you watch the one that you're falling in love with. You don't know them yet because you haven't known them that long. So you're watching them. You're getting to know them. You have no expectations of them. You're just watching them. That is exactly what it's like. He is completely 100% correct. And the more that I watch the self, the more I love the self. The more it is such a joy to realize that's what I am. And the more I want to watch it. I was talking, Jacqueline says, like the book Dating God. I haven't heard of that book, but I love that title, Dating God. That's wonderful. Don't tell Ron, he might get jealous. I'm dating God. Boy, that would make somebody feel insecure, huh? But when I was in Ireland, I did run across a couple of women who were in empty nests, like I am actually now, right? They had children, and their children had, you know, left, and now the children had their own lives and weren't totally focused on them anymore, didn't need their attention anymore. But they were unhappy because of this. They felt something was lacking. And I was like, oh my God, it's the greatest gift in the world to be alone. Oh my God, you have the greatest gift in the world. Now, I said, you know, I love my daughter too, but to a point, children are a distraction. Now you have all the time just to sit and be. Now you have time to date God. What a wonderful gift, the opportunity to be alone with your lover, your beloved, the true one. This is how I feel, genuinely. I also feel secretly that Michael Langford wrote the book, How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love, just for me. And I feel that way because it came right when I needed it. And it taught me how to fall in love. And what's so wonderful about dating God is that you can date God all of the time. You can date God when you're laying in bed at night, wide awake, and you can't sleep. You can date God while you're doing the dishes. You can date God while you're teaching in the Awakening Together Sanctuary. You can date God all of the time. And the more you fall in love with that truth, the more you date God. In other words, the less often that you forget about it and get lost in your thinking again, go back into your habit of being deluded again, right? The more you fall in love, the less you're attracted to the habit of delusion. So again, this particular quote, I am that which is beyond the body, mind, and senses. Now let me read what I wrote in the journal. So this was on June 20th, 2013. What am I? What am I when I am in non-dreaming sleep? Am I this person in non-dreaming sleep? Am I existent or non-existent in non-dreaming sleep? With this considered, what am I and what am I not? Now this is a contemplation The quote led to a inquiry contemplation. I spent a long time, maybe months, maybe more than months, with this contemplation in my mind. Because there was this intuitive feeling that there was this sticky idea that I was the mind. That's what I call the habit of being deluded. There is this sticky idea that I am the mind, and I really had to get past that stickiness. And the best way I could find within myself to get past that stickiness is to look at when there's no mind and basically ask, what am I then? What am I then? Because I know I still am when there's absolutely no mind. And right now, the best experience of absolutely no mind that I have on a regular basis is deep sleep. I have that experience nightly. I have an experience of absolutely no mind nightly. No space, no time, no me. No mind. What am I then? The first answer that comes to my mind is isness. I am still isness. I am still is. I am still being. When there's absolutely no mind, there is being. When there's mind, there's being. If I'm completely deluded, and I'm completely angry at all of you, and I quit awakening together, you know, I'm fed up with this, there's still being. And when there's no mind, there's being. Therefore, being must be what I am. Isness must be what I am. The other thing is awareness. Not subject-object consciousness. There isn't subject-object consciousness in deep sleep. But there's still awareness. And I'm aware of that for two reasons. One, there's something that isn't intellectual that we all know that we love deep sleep. It isn't intellectual because the mind isn't there in deep sleep. So the mind can't look back at deep sleep and remember loving it, right? Because there is no mind. But somehow we still know that we love it. So there's some kind of an awareness there of the bliss of no mind. And then there's also the awareness that can call us back into subject-object consciousness when an alarm goes off, when a baby cries. If there was no awareness at all, nothing could pull us back into subject-object consciousness. But there is awareness. And these are the only, and there's awareness here now, right? Right now there's awareness. Whether I'm happy or unhappy, there's awareness. So when I looked for what is constant, always here, whether there's mind or not mind, whether there's right mind or wrong mind. So whether there's wrong mind, right mind, or no mind, what's here? What am I? And all I could find was isness, awareness. And I can't separate that from me. I can't shake it off. I can't run away from it. Right? It's always here because it's what I am. So again, the quote was, I am that which is beyond the body, mind, and senses. And then the journal entry was an inquiry that took me into a deeper contemplation. And the inquiry was, what am I? What am I when I am in non-dreaming sleep? What am I, this person, in non-dreaming sleep? Am I existent or non-existent in non-dreaming sleep? With this considered, what am I and what am I not? And that ends my time. So I am going to let go of the mic, and my dear friend Jacqueline is going to pick it up. And I think what we're going to do now is discuss the movie 45 Years. So Jacqueline, the mic is yours.